You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 209 by Rudolf Steiner, 11 Lectures, translated by Agnes Schneeberg de Stuhr. This is entitled The Language of the Cosmos. This is the last lecture in the series, the 11th lecture. It's in a subsection called Cosmic New Year. And it is Lecture 11, given on New Year's Eve in Dornach on December 31st, 1921. I believe that on this day, the turning point between the old and the new year, it is also appropriate to speak about a turning point in the history of humanity's development. And I will speak today about a particular turning point, the change in human cognition that occurred in the time of transition between the oldest period that humanity can look back on in an historical sense and our own time. It was especially in these earliest times that people were quite aware that any knowledge of the human being's actual, deeper, essential nature can only be attained when those forces of cognition that are concealed in the human being are brought to the surface. It had always been said that perceptions of the external world can only lead to knowledge regarding the external nature of the human being. But, within the special proceedings in the mystery centers, the possibility had been provided for those aspiring to do so, to achieve a higher knowledge of the real human being through forces otherwise hidden in the depths of human essential nature. People were quite aware, especially in those earlier times, when a certain instinctive wisdom prevailed, that the true nature of the human being is different from what can be found in the everyday surroundings experienced in ordinary life. This is why mention was often made of initiation as the only means through which the deeper secrets of life related to human essential nature could become accessible to human beings. Even today it is necessary to speak of an initiation in this regard, and anthroposophical spiritual science is able to show this. People can say, of course, that today's human consciousness, which has developed under very specific, egotistically driven conditions, resists the idea that real insight into the human being and the world can only arise through such special preparations and developments within the human soul. That modern human beings would like to make decisions regarding the most far-reaching questions of life strictly based on what ordinary life exposes them to, without resorting to such methods of inner development. And when people have a sense that they cannot decide about these highest questions of life with the usual powers of knowledge, then they claim that the human faculty of cognition has limitations anyway, and that it would be absurd to try to go beyond these general limits of human cognition. People also demonstrate prejudice toward the principle of initiation by questioning whether the things presented by this science of initiation have any merit for those who cannot yet achieve such initiation in their present incarnation, and how such people could become convinced of a truth that is the result of a specially prepared faculty of cognition. But this is not how these things transpire, and the latter objection in particular is quite unwarranted. For what does actually happen when a human being encounters the findings of the science of initiation? Let us assume that someone first enters a dark room. While walking around, that person distinguishes objects through their shapes by touching them. Suppose this room is suddenly lit up by a lamp placed somewhere, in such a way that it is not even noticeable in the room itself. All objects will now appear different to the usual faculties of the person who previously had walked around the dark room, had only touched things, and in doing so had formed a picture of the shapes of the objects in the dark room. With the light shining on them, all objects will now appear different, without anything having been added, without anything now becoming inaccessible to the person who is standing in the illuminated room. They will now reveal their nature, and at the same time the nature of the light. In the same way, when we encounter the science of initiation, all we need to do is to cautiously acknowledge what this science offers, regardless of whether we can directly attain it ourselves or not, and look at it in such a way that we allow this initiation science to shine its light on the things we know, on the world that is accessible to us. This science of initiation does not in any way attempt to bring something else to the world than what this world already is. But just as little as we can imagine what is in a dark room in the darkness, but are able to immediately recognize it in the light, just as little can the objects around us that exist for our ordinary consciousness reveal their inherent nature, unless they are illuminated by perceptions derived from the science of initiation. The real human being stands before us in the ordinary world, and this human being holds an immortal soul within. Just as a picture hanging on the wall in a dark room perhaps contains something that cannot be seen in the dark room. But once the room is illuminated, one can see it immediately. It is not as if the initiate had added the immortal soul to the human being. This soul becomes discernible to anyone once the essential nature of the human being is illuminated by the science of initiation. And only a prejudiced science can deny that the world in which we continuously exist with our earthly consciousness between birth and death, that this world itself, which can be accessed through ordinary healthy reasoning, confirms the truth of everything presented by initiation science. However, the science of initiation has itself undergone a transformation. It was something quite different in the ancient epochs of humanity, and is now appearing again in a changed form for today's human beings. Admittedly, between these two epochs lies a time of world evolution for humanity, a time that began around the 15th century and is now coming to an end, a time that was dark with respect to the spiritual light that initiation science aspires to be. Although its darkness is at the same time deeply ingrained in the nature of the entire evolution of Earth and humanity. If we look back to older times, whose traditions were still preserved in the Christian era, but began to fade away in the 15th century and eventually became incomprehensible during this time period, if we look back to these olden times, then we find that when human beings perceived the world with their instinctive forces of cognition, they did not merely see what can be perceived by human beings today through sense perception and intellect. In everything perceived with the senses, people saw something spiritual at the same time. Not in an abstractly spiritual way, but in a concretely spiritual way. They saw real spiritual beings. Even in the time of ancient Greece, people still saw these concrete spiritual beings. And one can trace this right down to the transformation of sense perception itself, and follow how it was that people were able to see such spiritual beings. Today, people believe that the tapestry of the senses, which is spread out in front of us, has always been the way it is today. But even external science can demonstrate that this is not the case. The Greeks, for example, did not see the blue sky in the same way as we see blue today. The Greeks had no concept of the blue in the sky. For them, this blue was shaded. On the other hand, they saw the so-called light colors more vividly and even more brightly than we see them. This can actually be inferred from the related literature. Furthermore, to a sense perception that perceives things in this way, the spiritual element lies directly spread out over the sense tapestry itself. It is only when the world begins to appear in a blue coloring, when it takes on a blue tinting, as it were, that this coloring lets the spiritual aspect of the external realm recede. But during that very time when human instinctive consciousness perceived something quite elementary in all outer things, human beings also perceived something elementary in their own soul, spiritual inner being. Today we speak of our conscience telling us one thing or another. The Greeks spoke of the erinyes. This was mostly the case when a particularly striking event occurred. Then the Greeks became aware that something like an elementary spiritual power was approaching them in the form of an objective entity. But in more ancient times, this was experienced in relation to all things, things which we now assume to simply arise from within the human being. People felt that this was brought about by something like an unknown spiritual force approaching the human being. However, what is absolutely normal in one era of human evolution should not occur in the same way in another time period. If someone today were to become conscious of a moral voice in the same way as was still the case in the earlier period of Greek development when Aeschylus was writing his tragedies, then this would point to a mental illness today, and people might well explain it by saying, although this expression no longer feels quite right today, that the person in question is possessed by an external power. Being possessed, in quotes, in this sense, was absolutely the normal condition in earlier Greek times. Today we must sense that what was felt to have come from an unknown power in earlier times now comes from within us, from our conscience. In the past, when a human being, having perceived out of an innate, instinctive awareness that elementary spiritual beings were working in the outer world, and also that elementary spiritual beings were working in one's own inner being, when that person was accepted as a pupil into the mysteries, then these elementary spiritual beings would be illuminated, as it were, by higher spiritual beings through the light of a new cognition. With an instinctive consciousness, people perceived nature spirits as well as certain demonic forces working in human nature. Through initiation, one descended deeper into nature and also deeper into one's own human essential nature. And the most meaningful, the supremely significant thing that occurred in someone who underwent the first stage of initiation in ancient times was that as a direct result of the initiation, one ceased to perceive both the elemental beings in outer nature and the demonic entities within one's own being. One could say that what is normal for us today, what we bear within us as our normal, natural view of the outer and inner realms, this is what the pupils of the ancient mysteries first had to acquire. Humanity advances in such a way that certain things that become natural at a later time have to be acquired through the science of initiation in earlier times. When, through initiation, someone had developed a perception both of nature and of the human being, as was available only to the mystery pupils at that time, then such a person could, in an individual way, approach the spiritual beings who governed both the essence of the inner human being and the essence of outer nature. This is why the principle of these older initiations was expressed in the following way. It was said that the pupil ascended from the ordinary view of life to the elements of earth, water, fire, and air. With the ordinary view at that time, what people saw was the elementary spiritual aspect of air, the elementary spiritual aspect of fire, the elementary spiritual aspect of water, and the elementary spiritual aspect of earth. It was only through the first stage of initiation science that earth, water, fire, and air could be perceived purely as such. The essential thing is that as humanity progresses, what takes the place of this perceiving of soul, spiritual, elemental beings, both in the external world and in the inner human being, is what can be called a soulless nature, and, if I may use this expression, a translucid human being, when inwardly observed. Today, when we look at the inner human being, we only see reminiscences of the outer world in the form of mental memory images. everything else remains invisible to us, just as a completely translucid body remains invisible. But when people in ancient times looked into their inner being, it was not in that sense spiritually translucid to them. They saw soul spiritual beings within their inner being. If things had remained like this, then human beings would never have been able to attain a full awareness of freedom. For this full freedom consciousness has only penetrated all of the human soul spiritual forces since this particular time period, during which the old instinctive way of perceiving the spiritual had been receding. Within the world of spiritual beings, necessity reigns. In that world, the activity of the spiritual beings prevails. In that world, the course of events is determined by what results from the activity of these spiritual beings. There, if one is engaged in soul, in this world of spiritual beings, then one is interwoven into a realm of necessity. There, one is bound to explore the longings, the intentions, the thoughts of the spiritual beings, in whose sphere one is interwoven, and to act in the sense of the intentions and impulses of these spiritual beings. There, one has no intention of realizing one's own impulses. In that world, there is no reason for freedom at all. It is only when we stand before a soul-less nature, when we do not find imprints of spiritual beings in nature, that we develop a cognitive knowledge in relation to the outer world, which no longer holds any reality, which only contains mental thought images. And the cognitive knowledge that has come down to us since the 15th century consists entirely of mental thought images. And just as little as images seen in a mirror imply anything compelling to us, just as little as, for example, the reflection of a person standing behind me, unseen by me, can attack me, just as little can thoughts indicate any real action, any real power. The thoughts that we carry within us, and humanity has attained the ability to grasp such purely pictorial thoughts, which do not reflect reality, only in the course of its development, that is, from the 15th century onward. These thought images cannot exert any kind of compulsion, any kind of determinations onto us. Inasmuch as they permeate our cognitive powers, we do not have to comply with them. Just as a mirror image cannot push me, so a thought cannot rule me. But just as I can make a determination concerning myself as the result of looking at an image in the mirror, so can purely pictorial thoughts determine my conduct. This is why pure thinking, the kind of pure thinking that has essentially become a human property since the 15th century, is the foundation for the human experience of freedom. This is what I wanted to address in my title, Philosophy of Freedom, at the beginning of the 1890s. That pure thinking is the basis of freedom. And spiritual science shows which place this pure thinking has in the overall development and the overall essential nature of the human being. How this pure thinking entered the historical development of humanity. This impulse of freedom has now, since the middle of the 15th century, entered humanity. It is here. It had to be gained through this perception of a nature devoid of soul, of an inner human being freed of spirit. It had to be gained at a time when supersensible realms were mentioned only in the traditional religious confessions and in the traditional philosophical worldviews, which no longer offer anything that can be directly experienced. If human beings were to persist much longer with this perception of a soul-less nature, of a spirit-free human being, then they would have to lose their connection with their own origin. The time is here, and a time will have to come, when people turn their attention again to their soul-spiritual origins, meaning that they will again become aware that in this world, the world in which we live, there is not just a soul-less nature, that we are not just participants in a soulless nature, rather that we live in a world that is filled with concrete spiritual beings. With a hard-won awareness of freedom, we will be able once again to immerse ourselves in the world of necessity. For within this world we will then be the very beings who have been summoned to freedom, inasmuch as we have in our physical incarnations gone through the state in which we are left to ourselves with our physical bodies. We can begin to explore the divine origin of the voice of conscience again, now that we have come to know the feeling of responsibility that arises from developing this freedom consciousness during the time when conscience only manifested as an inner voice in the human being, that is, as an image. It is not as if the development of humanity took its course in such a way, as so many supercilious modern minds believe. The people remained in a state of childlike comprehension of the external world for the longest time, and that they then finally reached the point where everything that now exists as knowledge, even with its limitations, must now remain as it is. No, this is not how evolution unfolds. Someone observing human evolution with an unbiased mind will find that this development of humanity has progressed from one stage to another stage, that the kind of knowledge we have at present also represents such a stage, and that human beings in future times will experience nature differently from how we experience nature today. As we look back at Thales today, and if we then say in a supercilious manner, quote, Thales childishly sought the origin of all things in water, but today we know better, close quote. And there are many who indeed believe that presently we know everything there is to know and will ever be able to know from what we investigate in chemistry and physics laboratories. If we adopt this supercilious view, then we would actually have to expect that there will come a time in future centuries when people, if they have that same attitude, would look back at our era and say, quote, these people of the 20th century still had such childish notions derived from their tests in chemistry and physics laboratories, close quote. But this is simply not how it is. These ideas, which seem so childish to today's supercilious minds, and which, according to this way of thinking, should at best only be considered historically, represent important developmental impulses which humanity had to go through in the past, just as it has to go through today's developmental impulses. And just as humanity has moved beyond Thales, so it will move beyond Lavoisier, will surpass Newton, will surpass what today is regarded as definitive knowledge, will surpass even Einstein. The world must indeed be thought of as in flux, also in a soul-spiritual sense. And we must think of ourselves as part of this living flow. But the fact remains that in the world of external manifestations, there is to begin with nothing that guides human beings to their own origins, that instead it has always been necessary to develop forces hidden within the human being in order to find the way to the realm of our human origins. Today, if we simply look at outer nature with our ordinary consciousness, with our ordinary sense capacities, then we do not readily find elemental beings. And as we look within ourselves, we do not readily find demonic entities. What we find outside are the laws of nature, and what we find inside ourselves is something like conscience and equivalent qualities. But if we actually develop what can be developed, in terms of our ability to form concepts, in terms of our ability to think in relation to the outside world, if we bring our faculty of thinking to the level where it comes alive, in the same way as otherwise only sensory perceptions come alive, then we will find the possibility again to perceive spiritual beings in outer nature. What had existed for the old instinctive consciousness, but in a way that is no longer useful for us, becomes visible to us again, visible to supersensible perception, if we solidify our thinking. With the kind of thinking that has become thin and pictorial, we no longer penetrate through to the spirit of nature. But if we condense our thinking, if we strengthen it, in the same way as we ordinarily have the strength of our senses, then we penetrate through the external tapestry of the senses to the spirituality that underlies the outer world, and we surpass the correctly presumed limits of the cognitive knowledge of our ordinary consciousness. We have to cultivate this self-education to the extent that we learn to look at ourselves with respect to these will impulses in the same way as we look at other people. And if we learn not only to look at ourselves, but also to form will impulses out of our consciousness in the same way as these will impulses normally only form passively in life, if, in other words, we do not just out of an inner necessity, but out of insight into the world, insight that solidifies into love for whatever impulse is entrusted to us, not only through our freedom, but also by the wisdom-filled world order. If in this way we make ourselves into the executors of the impulses that are needed in this world for world guidance, then this love will solidify within us. Then we will develop a loving devotion to purely spiritual impulses. And when this devotion has undergone the necessary schooling, then we will be able to find the spiritual within us again, and we will find the harmony between the spiritual in outer nature and the spiritual within. For wherever the search for the spirit has been carried through far enough, people have arrived at the same results. When the initiates of the ancient mysteries searched in the outer world and found, as they called them, the higher gods, then they turned their gaze back into the inner realm of the human being and found there, as they called them, the lower gods. But in the end, they arrived at a stage of development where the world of the higher gods and the world of the lower gods were one, where the above became the below and the below became the above, where the kind of definitions that were derived strictly from the spatial realm were no longer applicable or essential. And this is also the case with respect to initiation today. We penetrate into the soul spiritual aspect of nature. What is then revealed to us is not a world of atoms bumping into one another, but rather the spiritual powers of the spiritual beings behind our sense perceptions. And what is revealed to us when we look inward, beyond the limitations of memory, to the soul spiritual beings within the human inner being? But these two worlds, the outer world of spirituality and the inner world of spirituality, eventually merge into one. Pictorially, we are already able to view this one spiritual world. Take human beings with their ordinary consciousness. We look out into outer nature, we perceive color, light. We direct our other senses toward outer nature. We perceive sounds, differences in warmth, and other sensory qualities in external nature. We then look at our own body. We perceive our own body in its sensory qualities. We look at nature. It reveals itself to us in sensory qualities. We look at our own body. It reveals itself in sensory qualities. When we begin to activate our will, when we wander through the world, we become aware that these forces of will work into and affect the movements of our eyes, that even already, for our sensory perception, the same thing flows into the essential nature of our eyes as what directs the movements of our legs. If we immerse ourselves deeply enough, even externally, into the sense perceptible, then we become aware of the same thing as what transpires when we connect to the outer world through the unfolding of our will. What actually happens is that the sense-perceptible world merges into a unitary world for us. This flowing together into a unity, this merging of the sensory world, is superficial, but is nonetheless a reflection of the merging of the world of outer spirituality and the world of inner spirituality. By uncovering these two worlds, which are one unitary world, human beings become aware again of their soul spiritual origins. And so, One could say that today we stand at the end of an ancient time, a time that shows an earlier epoch during which human beings were able to see into the spiritual worlds, both when looking out into nature and when looking inward. Then came a time when it became dark, when the darkest triumphs were celebrated, particularly in this domain of darkness, without initiation science. But the cosmic year has ended. The cosmic New Year's Eve is here. A new cosmic year must begin. What we were able to say about Christmas is what we also want to experience in relation to a symbolic festival such as the one that is approaching us at this moment. We want to experience it in the same way. We want through such a festival to experience symbolically the turning point in time, which must, even today, already be perceived as a cosmic turning point in time. Times have become serious. They have become so serious today that we must of necessity look upward from the narrowly defined events occurring within the limited horizon, which the majority of humanity prefers to recognize as the only legitimate one, to the cosmic expanses, also to the cosmic expanses of human soul spiritual experiences. This is where we witness the cosmic turning point in time. If we become aware of this cosmic turning point in time, then we become aware that a cosmic new year of the spirit must begin for humanity. Only if we learn to recognize such things will we be able to feel true humanity in our present era. For true humanity is experienced only when the human being who goes through repeated lives on earth finds the possibility in each single earthly life not only to feel as a human being in general, but as a human being with specific tasks related to the specific epoch during which one of these lives is taking shape. Human beings can live with eternity only if they find the possibility of living in time in the right way. For the eternal should not only be revealed to the human being in time, rather through the human being and through time, the eternal should become something that can be experienced by the human being. The eternal holds sway in timeless duration. It also holds sway in timeless duration through all human existence. But its pulsations are seen in the events of each single epoch and in how they impact the human experience. And it is only when we experience these pulse beats and are able to unite them into a comprehensive rhythm that we will experience the eternal through time. Duration belongs to our true human nature. We can only experience duration if we lovingly and with inner strength let the individual pulsations of the eternal cosmic essence become our own experience. This is what I wanted to place into your hearts, into your souls today at this turn of the year. May the near future bring all of us the opportunity to use the impulses in our thinking, feeling, and willing, those we are capable of developing as our best impulses within our inner being. May we use them in this sense, in the smallest and, if granted to us, also in a larger context. The end of Lecture 11, and that is the end of this volume, Collected Works 209 by Rudolf Steiner, The Language of the Cosmos. I'll give you the whole title. The Language of the Cosmos, Cosmic Influences and the Spiritual Task of Northern Europe, The Human Being as an Earthly and Cosmic Being, Father Consciousness and Christ Consciousness, The Festival of the Appearance of Christ, Cosmic New Year. 11 lectures held in Christiania, Oslo, Berlin, Dornach, and Basel, from November 24 to December 31, 1921, translation by Agnes Schneeborg de Stuhr.